This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Diana, thank you so much for that treat and that amazing educational experience, everybody here in the audience. Can you just tell us a little bit about your filmmaking process, how you got this idea, and what made you decide to pursue it, how long it took you?
Sure. So 8 years ago is when the project started. I was a graduate student at the time studying in an international studies program, and I was reading a lot about offshore spaces, which is why it was so interesting that you mentioned Foucault earlier, his essay on other spaces about heterotopias, these sort of places outside of, spaces outside of place, was a real inspiration for me in terms of just thinking about the geopolitic and what's possible in this globalized world. And so many examples of people using that space were for criminal activity or personal gain. And this was an example, one of the first examples I found that really struck me of someone occupying this offshore space outside of a domestic jurisdiction with a social justice agenda, with a mission to make the world better. So there was a real intellectual attraction to what they did for me that got me started. And I had a background in film, in production design in the art department, art departments of film. But I hadn't actually directed a film before, a big project. And one of the first interviews I ever gave on film was with Rebecca. And one of those scenes is in the film. So I think that, you know, I sort of jumped in not knowing it was going to take 8 years. You don't do it if they tell you. So I learned how to make a film and then became much more emotionally connected to what they were doing and to the, you know, to their mission, and just by seeing the global need for what they did and for what they do, and the dedication with which they address it.
I want to just pick up on asking about your work as a documentarian, because I noticed that Chicken and Egg, which is a women's film funder, of which there are very few, a production company, is credited on the film, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the other women directors that you're working with in that project, or that they're funding. I was really curious about the reproductive rights cohort.
Yeah, this is great. Chicken and Egg, especially one of their founders, Judith Helfand, has been a cheerleader for this project since, you know, the early days, and they came on, you know, when there was enough of a shape of a film that they knew they could support it. They were a great supporter all along, energetically. And what they've done since, the landscape since I started making this movie has changed so dramatically here in the States. There's been a lot of films that are, you know, coming up to explore what we're encountering here. And there's eight films in particular that Judith and Chicken and Egg have identified as this reproductive rights cohort of films that are all in various stages of production. One of them that you might have recognized is After Tiller, which came out last year. And a few others are sort of, you know, in pre-production or editing stages. And we're sort of a group of films that will be touring medical schools and maybe beyond that over the coming years.
To me, there's a connection between the sort of grassroots activism that we see in the film and independent media. Like, just take it over. Do it yourself, because you're not going to get the depictions that you want to see from, you know, the powers that be.
There's a lot of independent film that can take a lot of risks. And I think, you know, there's a lot of, I guess you're also getting at the sort of iterative nature of how Women on Waves works and how they started with this one idea and sort of encountered antagonists that came their way. You know, you have two choices. You can either stop what you're doing, or you can alchemize what you're confronted with something that's going to make your project stronger. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think Rebecca, as an activist, as a leader, is very good at. Letting what comes her way evolve the project into the sustainable project that it's become.
I think the visual media is also a nice representation for us of the invisible, and reminds us of how invisible women can be in this dialogue, and the fact that for the most part in the film, it's the activists telling us the women's voices and their stories and experiences. It makes you really can connect with the empathy involved through that experience of listening to a woman's experience through somebody else.
Yeah, it is a story about the activists, but what drives them are the women. And because they work so remotely, they're working through telephone calls and through emails, we really had to think about how we were going to represent them. We didn't want, to expose anyone's privacy. That's a huge point. But we wanted to get their stories in there because it humanizes what's going on and it drives our main characters. So what we ended up doing is, as you saw, involving the text on screen and letting the women speak for themselves in that form. It also led to the evolution of these animations that we use that were all done by an animator named Emily Hubley, who comes from animation royalty, and her parents' work is in the MoMA, and she's probably done a lot of work that you've seen in various films. But the first animation was really a solution to a logistical problem of having to communicate all of this information that you needed to understand before we could even get to the story. The international laws of the sea, this abortion pill, et cetera. We were trying to do it with Verite and interview, and it was just lost on people, so on test audiences. So that solved a problem for us. But also the third animation, which details the use of misoprostol, how to use it, was really something that we saw having legs of its own in addition to the film itself. So right now we've exported it and we started to translate it. We just got our 11th language translation yesterday, which was Bengali. So they're coming in from a lot more than the predictable languages that we thought we would have it translated into. So that's exciting. It's one of the ways we're sort of building outreach around the actual film.
Yeah, it really adds another layer to the educational purpose of your movie. It's direct service education, actually.
Yeah, the film is a Trojan horse in that sense. Mm-hmm. It contextualizes what they're doing, but it also basically been through a small training.
And I think through Emily's piece as well, that was my first introduction to Vessel. We get this sense about the relevance of this topic to the United States. And I wonder if 8 years ago, Diana, you had a sense of what the relevance would be to this country. And I think Emily's journalism really made all of us think in that way about how this might be more directly relevant to us than we might want to admit.
But I would imagine it probably didn't feel relevant to the United States when you started working on this
project. No, yeah, we thought it was a foreign story. We thought it was going to be a story about other women's experience, and that's exactly what we've seen. It's become a local story, and women in half of the country now are living in the same realities as the women visited by Rebecca Shipp.
Right, and so then when I was working on a magazine story about what Rebecca is doing now, one of the things that prompted the story was this question of why is there no activism like this in the U.S., and would we have a need for that? And Rebecca has changed the focus not of her cause, but of how she works. So she has moved from voyages onto the internet, really, and is spending her time mostly in a small office in Amsterdam with staff and volunteers answering women's queries that come in over email from all over the world, and trying to translate this idea of access to misoprostol and mifepristone into a service that she can deliver over the internet. So she found a drug supplier in India who I had a lovely Skype conversation with, who is fulfilling all the prescription requests. And she has doctors in places that she doesn't want to disclose and didn't tell me, who are writing the prescriptions. She thinks that they're doing that legally under their law, even though those prescriptions are then being filled for women who live all over the world. So it's this sort of like jerry-rigged system involving a number of kind of people willing to really push the boundaries of law and of normal medical and pharmaceutical practice. Mm-hmm. And because it is so boundary pushing, in this country, it's hard to imagine the same sort of model. And I think also it's worth thinking about, and Corey, I'd love to hear your thoughts about the degree to which we would want this to be relevant here, because it really is a model that was designed for places where abortion is entirely illegal and not accessible, and that luckily is not the reality we live in here. So there's sort of an interesting play there.
Yeah. problem is access is becoming diminished in this country, so I think a little bit of thinking outside of the box is useful, and trying to think of adaptive ways in which we can utilize the examples of really amazingly creative problem solving pushes us to think that way. And the truth is, you know, medical abortion is a do-it-yourself abortion, right? I mean, it's a way to induce an abortion in your own home with your own support system in your own way on your own time. But mifepristone, the first medication that's taken, which is the reason why it's so highly effective, you know, I think it's a fairly big difference for something that's 80% effective mm-hmm. and something that's 95 or 96% effective, and how many failures you're going to have, and the consequences of failure are really important to consider for the women who suffer them. So mifepristone is the medication that makes this regimen more effective, and it is the most highly regulated drug in the United States. It has more regulations connected with it mm-hmm. than any other medication, even though it's safer than Tylenol. So these are sort of the loopholes that, I mean, when you think about loopholes or trying to apply loopholes when there things are very tightly bound and controlled, it feels more stifling to the creativity. Mm-hmm. And so I thought it was interesting even in the film how the discussion about using misoprostol was a trigger for a lot of the team members. You know, publicizing the use of misoprostol alone seemed, one of the women in the film, the activist, said that that was Rebecca's choice, mm-hmm. not their team choice. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to consider what the consequences are of if we were only going to use that one medication or using them, and how regulated the most effective part of the regimen is.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying using it alone rather than in the preferred protocol with the other medicine?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
That she went. Okay, just clarity.
Yeah, sorry if I wasn't clear about
that. No, you were.
It was me. But I think that is really the direction that at least the film showed women on the web going. Mm-hmm. If you can't access mifepristone, use misoprostol alone. And yes, it works 80% of the time using that WHO regimen, but 80% is not the same as 95%. And for American women, we'd prefer them to be able to, for all women, but in a mm-hmm. country where it's legal, to be able to use the most effective regimen.
One of the things I spent some time reporting on over the summer was what kinds of pilot programs have been tried here that give some support to the DIY nature of the abortion. So if women have questions or if they want to have, want to be certain afterward that the abortion is complete, what kinds of structure needs to be in place? And there are starting to be some really promising research results about a couple of different regimens. I wonder if maybe you would describe that.
So I think I need more.
Well, I was just thinking about the research about the one that I was most familiar with is Planned Parenthood doing this huge study in mm-hmm. which they were only having two visits, mm-hmm. I think, right?
Yeah. Well, there's been a lot of, I mean, the progress has been phenomenal in terms of what the FDA actually approved for the use of mifepristone and misoprostol for medical abortion. That was only up to 7 weeks of pregnancy. It was a different dose. And over not that many years, I think about 15 years or so, we've made tremendous progress in making the regimen more effective and safer and more acceptable to women, which is really also discussed in the film, that it's really us understanding how to make these medications work better that makes it more available and the coaching of women through the process easier. We've been able to decrease the interval of time between the two medications, which shortens the overall abortion time and also allow more women to complete the process at home, as opposed to, and it started off in a clinic, actually, that women did medical abortion, the whole process, in a clinical setting.
And one of the things I was surprised to learn about is that the research shows very low rates of complication for women who are essentially getting the pills in a clinic with some kind of education, but then taking the whole process home with them and doing it themselves. And that's just such a different model. I think in the United States, generally, we're not used to the idea of people really taking their healthcare into their own hands. We tend to be pretty alienated from that and think of that as the purview of doctors. And so there's this kind of 1970s, you know, Earth Mother feminist ring to some of the activism here, that the idea of kind of taking back this power over women's bodies and giving them back to women.
Mm-hmm. Just as because I was thinking about a lot watching your movie, that a lot of women's filmmaking in the 70s that really came together about putting cameras in women's hands was also around putting speculums in women's hands. So some of those first movies are about self-health and, you know, making the movie that then could circulate to other kind of cells elsewhere, and that it would be a kind of network. So that really struck me, is that the women's health genre is, you know, the border crossing one.
Yeah, you know, in some of the places where I was filming trainings, I'm thinking in particular of being in Thailand, and there was a group from the Philippines that were there, and they were there. It was in a quiet room, a dark room, you know, upstairs from a conference that was happening during the day, and Rebecca and Kingo were doing these trainings after hours. And it was from people from all over the world, but there's this one group from the Philippines, which has very restrictive laws. And it was my assumption that they were there to learn the protocols. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought that's what they were there to sort of have confirmed, but I was proven wrong. They knew the protocols to the letter. Yeah. You know, they had it all down. All they wanted from my perspective was another human being to be there to tell them face to face, you're doing this correctly. Yeah. You know, you're not harming your patients. You're not putting anyone at risk. Not only are you doing this protocol, but so are, you know, is everyone else in this room who are from countries all over the world. And I think that was one of the goals for the film for me. When I say contextualizing the pill, it was really just, especially that montage in the end, showing all of these different countries that are doing these same protocols and these going through these same trainings. You know, it's the same the world over, and there's a solidarity to that.
Mm-hmm. That just makes me ask, I'm sorry, but did you travel with Rebecca, and how did that come about, the particular places that you shot?
Sure. So I started filming in Ecuador, which is in 2007. And my footage starts earlier with the Morocco footage that actually happened chronologically later, and some of the interviews that sort of sew the film together. But the cool thing about the earlier campaigns in Ireland, Poland, and Portugal was that they were donated to me by filmmakers and activists that have been on the earlier campaigns before I had started filming. So there really was even a not grassroots, but a community effort to tell the entire arc of the story. And we actually didn't even have that earlier footage until we were 3 months into editing. And I think that was in part because Rebecca was sort of seeing what I was going to do with it.
Yeah,
there's a very long, long, you know, earning of trust going on with her. But I got it.
Yeah, you clearly did.
It's kind of amazing to be there at those, you know, because you hear the story as you tell it from, you know, now and all the fame and notoriety that she has. But to see that, like, small little, there's three of us and we're, you know, hammering the the sign on the boat.
I was thinking as I was watching this film again how much this rests on her personal charisma and leadership. I mean, she's such a vivid character. And there is a way in which she, in some circles, is famous now, but she is still working in this little office, like on a pretty shoestring budget, with a number of kind of patched together volunteers and staff who are translating for her into different languages. It's just a reminder of how grassroots these kinds of efforts really can be. That it felt to me when I was doing this reporting with her that she really was outside of, you know, kind of mainstream big organizations. And one of the reasons that she's not serving women in the United States, because she gets a lot of queries over email, as you can imagine, from women who live in states that where there is so little access right now. She feels like the United States has a lot of funding and resources and that we should be able to deal with this problem. That, you know, she has this very limited resource and she wants to essentially reserve it for women in countries where there's just less healthcare, less money. And I felt like that was a kind of powerful challenge to this country when I heard her talk about it.
Yeah. It's legal. Do it.
Right.
And even her experience, the connection that she was able to make between the working individually with women to improve and change people's lives, but the feedback that had on governments, that it seems like, at least from the film, that she really influenced legal change in at least two countries that legalized abortion after the protests and all the work that she did. So,
right.
I mean, it's remarkable. So, and she's doing the same sort of thing in a reverse direction, hopefully, here. We'll see. But.
Right, but there is a way in which the most powerful dynamic of the campaigns was not so much that lots and lots of women got abortions right then, but that she was spotlighting this issue and using it to generate all the amazing press coverage that you were able to include.
Right, because every image in the press has the hotline number, mm-hmm. and or the website. And, I mean, the Ecuador hotline continues to today. I think they're still, last time I checked in with them, they were still getting about 10 phone calls a week. And that was in 2008 that they set up the Ecuador. I think I have the date right, but so it's been sustained.
We were talking earlier about what it is that people in the audience can do, what we all can do, sort of coming invigorated off of watching this film. I know you wanted to address that, Diane.
Oh, yeah. Well, so, yeah, we've been trying to figure out ways to sort of surround the film and harness some of the energy that I always feel when I'm present at screenings and people are interested, you know, how can we bring the boat to the Gulf of Mexico? And she's not coming. It's up to us to think, you know, like for all the reasons you just heard, and also because it's we're the most litigious and the most violent country in terms of the anti-abortion movement. And so, you know, the coming here might threaten the work that they're able to do in other countries for those reasons as well. So, you know, the call to action is to take a cue from her in terms of thinking so creatively, you know, both to use our resources, but also to really, you know, push the envelope in terms of creative activism. I mean, what kind of, it's totally absurd to give abortions on a ship in offshore. It's a completely ridiculous idea. And she did it. And look what it turned into. So, I mean, that's what I get from it. What can, you know, and for me, I had a skill set in film, and so that was the inspiration to sort of, you know, see how that could work as an offshore space in itself. But now that we have the film, you know, we have a website, it's vesselthefilm.com, and from there you can sign on to a social action network, which basically just connects you to our mailing list and our Facebook and Twitter pages, which are both at Vessel the Film. And what we're trying to do with that connection that we'll make with you is just connect you as much as possible to local efforts that are going on. There's no need for us to recreate, you know, any kind of umbrella outreach action when really the strongest effect you can have on the ground is really by, you know, playing into local action. So we hope you'll find us there and share your ideas with other people that are connecting with us as well.
And realize that Pennsylvania is a state where abortion access is really restricted for women, particularly who rely on medical assistance for their insurance. Mm-hmm. Abortion is only covered if, in the case of rape, incest, or life threat for women who are covered by medical assistance for their health care needs. So that leaves many, many women needing to pay out of pocket for induced abortion. And the Women's Medical Fund, who co-sponsored this event with us, is an organization that helps to offset the costs for women. So that's, you know, being involved with organizations like that, I think, is one way of continuing to improve the access problem.
I wanted to say, because you were just talking about how you're getting the film out there, but it's an interesting way that, again, the internet which, and social media, which might not seem like, you know, the most like 70s feminist kind of way of networking, really does go that route. Instead of, say, you know, having a big launch for your film on television, of course, you probably, you know, do want to have it on television.
We try to do that.
But you're going straight to the consumers immediately, and that's information as much as, yeah.
Right. I mean, that's why we have a community screenings campaign, which is why we're here. I mean, anyone, any group, large or small, can host a screening of the film, and what we're seeing from that is this really great trend of organizations using screenings of the film to bring visibility and funding to their own work. And yeah, we are on iTunes now, and we will be on Netflix in a couple months. So it's been great. We've been able to chase down more traditional distribution avenues as well. We had a week's run at the IFC Center in New York, which is extremely exciting. But yeah, it's mostly about these sort of local effort, which is now international. We have screenings in other countries as well too. They're growing, and it's about slowly building this this awareness.
I had another question for you about the construct of the film, speaking of communication. How the depiction of the press was fairly antagonistic, certainly with Rebecca, but also this sort of idea, it really felt like it was a hostile depiction. And I wonder if there was a message there in terms of how generally the press reflects issues around reproductive rights, or there was any part of that.
Yeah, I didn't have an intentional hostile feeling of the press. What I did notice with her experience of the press is it started with something that she felt maybe wasn't on her side.
Right.
And a really interesting evolution of her activism was learning how to take advantage of it and just really use it to her advantage and to use it as a medium. In the early days, when you ask her what got her started on the project, what made her actually do it, she had just... So there's the story you heard, which is that she was part of Greenpeace, and that's where she got the idea from traveling the world in the ship. And her boyfriend at the time was the captain of the ship. And they came up with this idea to use offshore space, and then she went home and had just written a novel. And she was doing press based on this novel. Yeah, she went to art school and medical school at the same time. She wrote a novel. She has two kids. She's a single mom, a full-time abortion pirate. I mean, who knows how she does it all. But so she'd written this novel, and so she was doing the press circuit on the novel, and because she just had this idea, typical Rebecca shooting from the hip, leaked it to the press, and they ran with it. And they're like, this woman's going to put an abortion clinic on a ship. And then she's like, oh, crap, it's in print. So then she had to actually do it. So there's. I think that, you know, even if she had a hard time dealing with the press in the early, especially Ireland chapters, there was an innate understanding of how powerful it could be to what she wanted to do. And then what you see happen to the project is it evolved from something that she thought was originally going to be a flotilla of ships, just, you know, bringing abortion to the shore, you know, safe abortions to places that don't have it. And it didn't end up being that. The ship now, at this point, is the spectacle that brings the hotline number to people, which brings, you know, information. So it was a real evolution with the media.
Great. We have some questions from the audience that are being collected, so I can...
If anybody has a question they want to write down, just flag...
I think you have a lot. Yeah. Or it's just... Oh, it's, okay. Sorry. Yeah. Great. Okay. Oh, so this question is, how about the role of nurses and midwives in changing the scope of practice, which is a great question.
I think you can probably answer that.
Okay, I will. So I'll do my best to answer that. It's really an important topic because of the demand for abortion services and the lack of care providers to provide those services, even in the United States. But whether or not nurse practitioners or midwives or mid-level providers or advanced practice folks can provide services is regulated state by state. And there are very few states that will allow that, although we are making progress, like California actually just made it lawful for mid-level providers to provide abortion services. So that's, you know, like most of this, it really depends on where you live.
Here's some more questions for you, Corey.
I don't know if you
have
anyone
else.
This
one I think you can take.
Do you want me to read
easily?
One?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's great.
Excellent. I want to give money to a woman who can't afford an abortion. What local organizations can I give to? So, yay you. And the Women's Medical Fund is the local organization that funds abortions for women who can't afford that on their own. So, Women's Medical Fund.
This issue of funding nationally is becoming more prominent as clinics close and women have to travel distances. There is more of an effort to try to help offset the cost of the transportation or the childcare if you have to leave your kids behind, since most women who have abortions actually are moms. And so it's a sort of different kind of pro-choice funding than we've sometimes thought of in the past, but it's emerging, particularly in states like Texas, as being pretty important for access.
Yeah.
Planned Parenthood Day of Action would like to be announced.
Okay.
To the assembled crowd.
Okay. I'm announcing the Planned Parenthood Day of Action 2015. Join us and let your voice be heard on April 13th. It's in Harrisburg, the state capitol, from 8 till 5, and a rally at the Rotunda from 2 to 3. So that's another opportunity for activism.
And this is another important question.
Okay. Oh, great. Can you discuss the role of telemedicine in the provision of abortion care in the U.S.? Yes, a little bit we can talk about that. So telemedicine basically means providing medical care remotely, and that's utilized in many ways, and there are experts in this room in telemedicine for a variety of medical conditions. And the idea behind it is in places where that service may not be immediately accessible, there may not be a specialty dermatologist in this corner of a state or in a rural area, that a dermatologist potentially could look at pictures of a disorder and make a diagnosis and recommend therapy remotely. And that those strategies are being used to provide medical abortion for women who are trying to access care but they are too distant from a clinic to travel to that clinic. And it's, you know, quite similar to the model of Women on Waves, actually, which is why one reason why it's very relevant and one solution to the problem of diminishing clinic access for women in parts of the United States. And studies have actually shown it's very effective, especially when done in a precise way of following a specific protocol where the physician actually sees pictures of the woman's ultrasound in advance, so verifying how far along in pregnancy she is, verifying any other important clinical information that makes this safe for her, and then they can actually push a button in their home clinical facility that opens the drawer to the highly regulated mifepristone where that woman is accessing care. So this still involves going to a clinical space. It's not, and having physicians mostly, I'm sure in these states it's all physicians, providing the care, the abortion care, and then also the follow-up and all the counseling that's involved. That's, you know, one of the key components of the success of medical abortion for women is excellent counseling because of all you saw described in the film, the bleeding and cramping and the discomfort and knowing when there's a problem and when there's not a problem. So I hope that answers the question. There is definitely a place for telemedicine in the United States. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so Susan's mentioning that it's being outlawed in some states. I mean, there actually have been many laws passed against medical abortion in the past couple of years in different states, including ones that forbid doctors from even providing evidence-based regimens to their patients, requiring them to stick to the FDA-approved labeling, which we use drugs off-label all the time in medicine. That's normal medical practice. It costs $1 million for a pharmaceutical company to change a label, so you can't do that every time you want to change your regimen based on the latest study. So unfortunately, like in Ohio, for example, a woman can't get a medication abortion at 9 weeks of pregnancy because the law has been changed that it has to be 7 weeks of pregnancy, according to the label, and telemedicine is also being legislated.
You have some over there, right?
I have a question. Are the abortion pills being used in the U.S., and can women get them from Canada or Mexico?
Are the abortion pills being used?
So they are being used in the U.S. Yes. With a prescription.
Yes.
And so I think the more underground question methods in this country are ordering pills over the internet. And the trickiness of that is that you don't necessarily know that you're getting good drugs from a legitimate supplier. And often if the pills, when they come, you don't come necessarily in a clear dosage. And all of the counseling Corey was just describing also, it doesn't necessarily follow along. So there certainly are women in the United States who are trying to get pills through the mail despite all of those obstacles. But it's a little bit dicey. On the one hand, you know, one would hope there would be access for people who really need it. On the other hand, if they're not getting medication that is legitimate medication and they don't know how to use it, that could cause a lot of trouble. So that's the kind of fine line there. And Rebecca Gombert has found a way around that, as I mentioned earlier, by connecting with a supplier who she trusts in India. But, you know, he can't come and advertise in the United States because we have real restrictions on prescription medication.
Yeah, I would add that in Mexico, I mean, that in Texas, there are a lot of women getting the pills from Mexico. When we premiered at South by Southwest back in March, we connected with a lot of groups that are working on the ground, both in the field and doing research, helping to connect women to misoprostol, especially women in the Rio Grande Valley that don't necessarily have any access to getting out of that area. Maybe they're undocumented or for whatever reason, economic reasons. So that is definitely happening on the border. It's not happening as visibly as some people would like it to be because it would be so quickly shut down.
And there's real legal risk also.
Mm-hmm. Emily, this is a question for you. As a journalist, how do you approach or recommend approaching audiences for film or written news who are anti-abortion or ambivalent?
Oh, that's a good question. I think that this is an incredibly divisive issue, and it's not an issue that everybody is open to the other perspective on. And I think if you feel strongly pro-choice, then you can kind of at least try to imagine what it would feel like to feel equally strongly on the other side. So I try to be very respectful of those convictions because I think they often come from personal feelings about religion or morality. And it's sort of the pragmatist in me also, I don't think it's really effective to question people about that. I do think, though, that there's also some ground in the middle that most Americans share, particularly around birth control. And one of the weaknesses of the traditional anti-abortion groups is their complete unwillingness to engage about contraception. When you try to press them on this question, as I've done as a reporter, they just really don't want to talk about it at all because there is enough resistance in their base, even to birth control, that they don't want to be associated with it. But I think to most people, that is kind of nonsensical. Birth control is used by something like 99% of people in the United States. And so that's like at least a place to start in terms of trying to open common ground on this issue. But I do think I find it to be the most divisive issue that I write about, and I've been surprised myself at how entrenched that division has proved to be over the decades. But I do think that's the reality of it.
So I think maybe we can close with the audience is wondering about your future pursuits.
So am I.
And we can brainstorm your next movie project.
Yeah, that would be great.
Are you
going
to stay in reproductive rights, and how will you continue to bring women's voices into the arts?
Right. So it's too much a part of me at this point to not be at least somewhat involved in this issue moving forward. I'm not sure what my next film will be. We're still so, full-time promotion, full-time outreach, and that will be for at least another couple of months. But yeah, there's going to be some soul searching coming up when I shelve it because this has been 8 years. Did not have this many gray hairs when I started. So stay in touch, I'll get back to you on that question in about a year, I hope.
Thank you all so much for coming tonight.
I also want to thank all of you for your presence here tonight.